Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, riveting testimony in the trial of admitted marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. Here's WBUR's David Boeri describing testimony from the Chinese businessman who says he was carjacked by the late Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Do you know the Boston Marathon explosion? I said, yes, I know. He asked, do you know who did it? He said, I did it, and I just killed a policeman in Cambridge.
Also, a watchdog group is calling for a stop to all expansion of the MBTA until the underlying problems are solved. Here's Eileen McEnany with the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation.
The operating budget is very much out of line. Expenses are outpacing revenues by 2.5 times.
And the T is offering a day of free rides to atone for service disruptions of this winter. Meantime, lawyers plan to sue the state to lift the cap on charter schools. Attorney Michael Keating says it's a civil rights issue.
There is an enforceable constitutional right to such an adequate education and not to a two-tiered educational system, which is frankly what we have particularly in the inner cities.
And pressure builds on Boston 2024 to open its books. Congressman Michael Capuano is calling for a more open process.
It's a big, huge mistake that plays into the argument that they have not been transparent with people.
Boston 2024 released its payroll, and the numbers have left many observers stunned. So joining us now to discuss these stories in detail and the rest of the week in the news is Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer. Great to see you again, Shannon.
Thanks for having me here.
Also with us, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Also great to see you again, Jim.
Good to be with you.
All right, so let's start off with the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev, now admitted marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev, that's been going on last week and this week. Deng Meng was one of the folks who testified this week. He said he was carjacked by the late Tamerlan Tsarnaev 3 days after the marathon bombings. Here is an excerpt of a call jurors heard in the trial, Deng Meng's 911 call.
Tell me what happened. Somebody took your car?
Yeah.
And what happened when they took their car?
They are the suspect of the marathon explosion.
Wow, just one of many intense moments in the trial so far. So, Shannon, let me just first get your impressions. What do you make of what we heard this week out of federal court?
My impressions is that it continues to be one of the most dramatic court cases probably in the history of Massachusetts legal cases. It's just amazing what these people have gone through. And again, because the defense has taken such an unusual strategy, it's generally a one-sided bit of testimony on the part of the prosecution. So it just continues to be fascinating and, frankly, shocking and very saddening for a lot of people to hear this again.
And that unusual strategy being having admitted Jahar Tsarnaev's guilt in opening opening statements and then for most, not all, but most of the witnesses so far declining to even question them in cross.
Right, cross-examination. And, again, it is just amazing. I think all of us, our jaws dropped when Jokar's attorney first said he's the guy who did it. I think people did not really think that would happen.
Mm. Now, Jim, that actually leads me to something that Alex Beam wrote in his column in the Boston Globe this week. Because as Shannon said, like, there's a lot of detail, like granular detail about what happened and the investigation. And now we're into the carjacking and the Watertown shootout. So Alex Beam wrote that he wonders if what we're seeing is a modern day show trial. I mean, he asks, what is our government trying to show and to whom? I'm just, first of all, wondering what your reaction is to that, Jim.
Yeah. Look, I think Alex's view of this and the view of many regarding the value of the trial is based upon perhaps a view of their view of the death penalty. It's largely informed by that. So, look, I'm against the death penalty, full disclosure. I don't believe we should give the government the power to take away the lives of Americans, and we should remember that he is an American. By the same token, I think there is a real civic purpose to the trial. If well argued, we can learn, we can humanize everybody in this process. And if it's poorly argued, we can dehumanize people. It's sort of a test of our culture. It recalls to me John Adams when he defended the British military in the Boston Massacre, not to make a connection between Jahar and the Boston Massacre, but He asked people to look past their British nationality and look at the individuals. I think we need to look at the individuals. I learned a lot from what we saw about Sean Collier. We need to know who had the gun when, who leaned inside the car. We need to know all of this stuff. And I think it's good for us to go through that process.
Mm. Well, let's move on to the tea. Even though the snow is melting, the tea is still in the news. The Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation released a report this week saying that any MBTA expansion should be put on hold until the system's finances are stabilized. MTF President Eileen McEnany told WBUR's Morning Edition that the governor should take over the agency on an interim basis. Let's listen.
We're not saying that revenue may not be required. What we are saying, though, is it's premature to have that conversation because we don't know the extent of the problems facing the T. And before we talk about putting new money, I think we need a better sense of what is confronting the T.
Jim, the governor has a task force, right, looking at the books here, but there seems to be a lot wrong with the MBTA right now. What do you think? Thoughts?
Well, you know, we've done a lot of work on this, and I'm really pleased to see the Mass Taxpayers report come out because it largely coincides with everything that we've said, with a few exceptions. We know that the run rate in terms of expenditures is well beyond what we're bringing in terms of revenues. Part of that is a cost issue. Part of that's a management issue. Just to give you one example. David Schaffenberg wrote this great piece on the cost structure
of the
Boston
Globe.
Yeah, Boston Globe, yep. And he noted that if you look at average salaries, we're really not that much of an outlier. What needs to be looked at is how many people we have working there, in what areas and all those. If you look at that, you see that we have, in some cases, two times the number of employees per, you know, whatever you want to go by, as well, or 1.5 times. I mean, we have a cost structure that is based upon lots and lots and lots of people working there. We have all kinds of issues around the maintenance of the system. We have not even been tracking up until very, very recently what the maintenance backlog is. There are all kinds of issues there. I think a couple things. I would agree that we have to halt expansions. I would agree that we need to take a look at the Pacheco Law and think about some very select privatizations to change the culture of certain aspects of it. I would go further than Mass Taxpayers and say we need a control board to run this, because we don't need to just diagnose the problem. We need a mechanism to implement in an emergency way to bring the system back, because we just disrupt the lives of 1.3 million people for weeks on end. It's still going on.
You know, you mentioned the story in the Boston Globe, but there was also a story in Commonwealth Magazine just this week recently, and it talked about a letter, actually, that was written by the state's commuter rail operator, Keolis. And that letter accuses the T of interfering with the hiring of the chief maintenance officer for the commuter rail. The MBTA had said Keolis was to blame for not filling that post, but this letter, which was written in December before we had the whole meltdown, cast doubt on that. So I'm wondering, I don't know if you're familiar with that letter, Shannon?
Yes,
but, you know, so what does that suggest here? Is that just another issue that's involving the MBTA?
I think it reflects a little bit of what Jim said and a little bit of what the Mass Taxpayers report and the Pioneer Institute report have come out with, that there are some institutional management issues that need to be fixed. We need to be taking a look at investing in the current infrastructure before you can move forward with some of the expansion plans. But that being said, even with the best management in the world, even if this was the most efficient per dollar transportation system in the country, it still has a significant an ongoing debt that is going to have to be supported with some new revenues. And whether that is, you know, we now have, you know, the speaker, Bob DeLeo, has said no new taxes, you know, no new fees. The governor said no new taxes, no new fees. But something, even if you put in place all those efficiencies, even if you take expansion off the table, you still have a structural deficit that has to be filled with additional revenues, and that has to be taken on honestly.
Mm-hmm. And of course, now we're hearing that there's going to be a free fare day to sort of make up for what happened, and I think 15% off passes in May.
If I can say, they interviewed one guy outside of the government center T station or outside of City Hall, and you know, most of the people were saying it's not enough. I want more. This one guy said, could they just keep the money and fix it? I need to get to work. And I think that guy is right. I mean, I think it's a it's a nice gesture. I think it's a public relations gesture. I think that they need to take every single penny that they have right now and put it into maintenance and put it into improving the operations.
But unlikely that's going to be enough, and so there's going to have to be some hard political decisions. Would you both agree with that?
Exactly.
Well, I agree with that. I think our proposal is, I would agree completely with Shannon, even if we do everything right, our proposal from the beginning has been that we take some of the debt load off of the T over a period of 4 to 5 years, take about $200 million off their debt load. Because even if we focus on the core system, unless we want to wait years to get it done, which has all kinds of economic impacts, we're in a tough place. And the other thing is the state did impose those projects on the T. It's not that the T willy-nilly said, oh, we'll take on an expansion project. That was all part of the big dig mitigation, which was signed on to by state officials.
Right, right. And so so we've got a lot of work to do and not a lot of appetite for raising funds.
Yeah. You know, but this is a conversation that we have over and over and over again. I feel like in this studio, there seems to be universal agreement that some sort of debt relief from the state is got to be part of the mix. But Shannon, I am curious because you have been in state government.
I'm kind of laughing because...
Like, how is that possible to make that happen on Beacon Hill?
We got here in the first place because we fobbed a lot of debt off onto the MBTA back when we were paying for the big dig. We fobbed it off onto, you know, Massport. We fobbed it off onto the MBTA. This was, you know, a constant refrain that you know, I had when I was treasurer. You know, I was actually at a retirement party for Eileen McEnany's predecessor, Michael Widmer, and Bill Weld was there, the former governor, and Charlie Baker were there, and it was... They were making a joke about when Bill Weld came into office, and he was, you know, first being briefed on the budget and everything else like that. And at the time he was running in 1990, he was also supporting a referendum which did not pass, which would roll back significantly the state's income taxes, which would have had devastating impact on our state budget. And Bill Weld, you know, either it was Bill or Charlie Baker said, "Whoa, I'm so glad that didn't pass." But this is also the sort of kind of little kabuki play that a lot
exactly.
of us get into. You know, it costs money. And when I was treasurer, and times at least for part of it were pretty good, you know, it was how do we in good times not worry necessarily about expansion, but how do we invest for the future? How do we make sure that we can pay our bills for the long run? Because the tendency is to kind of, the term that's been used interminably lately, kick the can down the road, and now in the middle of 8 feet of snow, the can right. kind of got stuck.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I like your use of the term kabuki theater, but that theater has a real impact on a million writers. All right, let's move on to another.
And excuse me, don't get me going on potholes, because I might talk off about last summer in the governor's race, I was in this room saying, why are we not talking about my needs and my commute? And that's, it's not just the MBT. It's also the roads and bridges around here.
Which are now worse than ever after. Okay, but we won't go there. We won't go there because there will be time enough for this during this endless winter for us to talk about road conditions. But let's move on to another big fight that's currently going on in the state and that might take a new turn, and that is over public education, because a group of attorneys in Boston is planning to sue the state to force it, in an attempt to force it, the state to lift its cap on charter schools. Attorney Michael Keating, who's one of those lawyers, told us that this is a civil rights issue.
There's nothing in this lawsuit that we're filing which is intended to diminish or to reduce or to do anything to hurt the district schools as they now exist. What we're trying to do is open the doors to children in this city who are unfortunately forced to be in unperforming schools to have the opportunity to be in high-performing charter school.
Okay, well, Lisa Geisbond, who's executive director of Citizens for Public Schools, shot back at that and said that charters create separate and unequal schools.
It might not be his intent to create a separate and unequal dual school system, but I think we've seen that that's been happening with charter schools drawing resources away from traditional district schools, but excluding certain types of students with significant special needs, English language learners, poor students whose families don't have the wherewithal to navigate the charter school system.
So, Jim, the Pioneer Institute has long been advocating for more charter schools, but I wonder what you make of the fact that now we're hearing this civil rights argument from both sides here, saying that children have a civil right to a great education, but they seem to be asking for two completely different solutions.
Right. No, I agree. Listen, the first thing I'd say is legal action should be, in my mind, is a sign of weakness of our civic discourse, in the sense that if we push what are essentially cultural vision issues, essentially politics, into the courts. We're forcing the courts to become political. We do this over and over again. It's inevitable to some degree, but it's not something we want to do terribly much. I think the other thing is this. Look, Brown versus the Board of Education was an important moment in the civil rights movement. Education has always been at the center of a civil rights debate. It's education what is what allows in a free society for individuals to rise, if they're going to rise. I think Barbara Madaloni has some very weak arguments in one way and some strong arguments. She's the head of the Mass Teachers right. Association, the largest teachers union in Massachusetts. The first thing is, if she wants to say that charter schools are creating a separate but unequal system, she has this problem that we're actually allowing parents to choose where they want to go. That, in Brown versus Board of Education, was a primary concern, giving parents an opportunity to actually go to send their kids where they want to go. The second thing is, with 16,000 kids on a wait list in Boston, it's a tough argument to make. The third thing is, charter schools, the charter school law allows for 225% of the tuition amount for a student to go back to the district schools to make them whole in case a parent decides to send a kid to a charter school. The weak part is, for the charter school folks, there are fewer English language learners and fewer special needs kids in the charter schools, and that's going to be a weakness.
Well, that's a significant weakness that those who advocate against lifting the cap keep pointing to. But Shannon, let me just briefly get your view. I mean, one thing that Jim said that some folks say is the wait lists in and of themselves are evidence that there is a demand, so why not lift the cap?
I go back to when we first passed the legislation to allow for charter schools, and I have had sort of tepid support. I've supported charter schools, but my belief is that they were supposed to be, quote, laboratories of innovation, not an alternative school system that replaces the traditional public school system that we have. And because they don't take all comers, as our traditional school system does, you know, there are some parents who do want to take them out of the traditional schools. This is another kick the can moment for me. If we have problems with curriculum, if we have problems with failing schools, why are we not taking the innovation and the changes that are happening at some of the charter schools and implement them in the public schools? If it's, you know, if we need to be looking at union issues, if we need to be looking at, you know, those types of things in terms of excellence and what we can do. I mean, again, I don't necessarily equate unions with lack of excellence. I don't want to say that. But the issues that give the charter schools some of the freedoms that I think help them, we should be looking at that for traditional K through 12 schools. But we don't want to do that. So we sort of create this dual system where people want to make a choice and we don't have enough money for everyone to go there.
Well, let's go on to our next topic before we run out of time. Speaking of money, let's talk about the 2024 Summer Games, the bid to hold them in Boston. Boston 2024 is a private group that's putting together this bid. This includes real estate developer John Fish, Patriots owner Bob Kraft, and this week the group announced that former Governor Patrick is on its payroll to the tune of $7,500 a day. Working for the group as a global ambassador. Lots of people raised eyebrows on that. I'm wondering, Shannon, what do you make of this? We're talking about a nonprofit paying 6 of the 10 staff members more than $100,000 a year. Is there a problem with that?
As the 2024 people have pointed out, they're raising private funds right now to pay for these salaries, and they certainly are healthy, good salaries for a number of different people. But the problem that we've seen this week, and I think that it's good that they've disclosed this, is that it kind of makes it look like everyone's political, everyone's a lobbyist, everyone is somehow politically connected either to the Patrick administration, the Baker administration, or the Walsh administration. So that in and of itself is not a bad thing, because there is a lot of politics that's going to go towards winning the support and to pave the way for something like this to happen. But it's the image. And I think Congressman Michael Capuano said it best. If the appearance is that even this privately funded organization is going to be so profligate in, you know, spending on salaries for lots of lobbyists and PR people, what does that say to the general public about whether or not they can trust them if indeed there are some public resources that need to be utilized. I mean, again, they have said that all of the transportation and infrastructure needs can be met within existing budgeted projects that remains to to be seen. But I think that it's the image that is the toughest thing that they're grappling with right now that they're going to have to fix.
And apparently, Governor Baker didn't even find out, and Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, didn't find out that Deval Patrick was working for the group until after the news media had contacted them. So there's also communications issues as well. Jim, I'm wondering, what do you think? Should the process be more open or what?
Oh, sure. I mean, they've been actually caught out misrepresenting information about what's been paid for, what's not been paid for. I mean, there are a couple of issues here. One is that it will certainly require public funds, and you have a private organization that may have impact on how public funds end up being spent. No one's really talked about this. The local committee has access to funds through sponsors of the Olympics. Ultimately, there are lots of benefits that it can accrue to that organization. It is incumbent upon them to actually be much more transparent, not to get caught up behind misrepresent. They have to be absolutely honest with this, or they're going to ruin their brand, and that will really deteriorate their ability to actually move this forward.
Mm-hmm. So explain what you mean a little bit about access to those funds. I'm unclear on that.
Well, there are a number of sponsorship funds that actually flow to the local Olympic Committee once it's set up. No one's actually talked about that issue, and I think people should understand ultimately how money will move around if we do get the Olympics. And you know, if we're going to take this seriously, we have to understand every aspect of, you know, follow the money.
Well, also, and remember, I mean, after, I mean, the Salt Lake City Olympics, I think that the federal government spent something like, because it was so close to 9/11, the federal government spent $1 billion on security there because they were, you know, worried about the heightened security risk, you know, at that time. So even though a lot of people have said there are not going to be public funds, there are going to be different public resources that will be, if not directly paid for, at least there will be some, you know, greater stress on our infrastructure, on our public services.
I think we're running out of time here. We've got just about enough time left for hubbubs. Those are the small stories that kind of got your imaginations. Jim, you have a hubbub today?
I do. So Channel 7 News adopted a brilliant marketing strategy, taking over the cash lanes at the Alston-Brighton toll on the Mass Pike Monday morning. About 700 happy commuters get a free ride into Boston. On the other hand, Easy Pass is testing out a marketing strategy they might call "We Are Nastier Than the IRS." The cashless tolling system on the Tobin Bridge works great if you've got a transponder gizmo, but if you don't, a camera snaps a picture of your license plate and they charge you 50 cents plus $2.50 for the toll. Well, here's the rub. If you don't get your bill paid in time, they only send it once a month. It goes up $50 for each time you went through the toll, what would have been the toll. And if you don't pay it the next time, it's another $40. So $90 on top of what would have been a $3 toll. We did a story with WBZ's I-team on this. We are now getting calls from people who are distraught. They've got $4,000, $6,000, you know, $7,000 bills, and they don't know how to pay them. These are regular people.
Wow.
A new definition to highway robbery.
Oh, my gosh.
Shannon, you're hubbub.
All right. My name is not just Shannon. It's Shannon Patricia O'Brien, and we're coming up on St. Patrick's Day. Where I'm from, the city of Holyoke, which has the largest parade in Massachusetts, my old Senate district. But the fact is, what's sort of interesting this week is the lack of stories about the St. Patrick's Day parade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they did have an article in the Globe today talking about the parade and who's attending. But I thought this, and this struck me the most, and maybe this was just one throwaway line, but for the first time in two decades, the mayor of Boston is going to be marching in the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And I just think that, you know, it's a great thing, and it's nice to see after so many years. This was a tough fight for a lot of different people to come together, and they're coming together. They're going to be coming together even more closely because the roads are going to be so narrow. but I think it's going to be a nice weekend. So I think that's a good news story.
That Marty Walsh knows a little something about Ireland. Okay, so you mentioned snow. My hubbub has to do with that as well, and this is out of Quincy in Wicked Local, which I love this. Okay, so basically, because of the snow and the narrowed roads, Boston did this too, but Quincy decided that they were going to just make certain roads that had become so narrow one way. Okay, maybe it makes sense for controlling traffic, except they failed to tell anybody. They just put up these one-way signs, 14 out of the original 130 roads that they were going to do. Christopher Walker's a spokesman for Quincy said, "We never released anything to the public." But in true Massachusetts style, people took this into their own hands, and neighbors were already taking down the signs anyway. And a lot of the signs have fallen into snowbanks. And the ones that remain are being removed. So an attempt at traffic flow is, you know, subverted by the Massachusetts driver.
That is hilarious. I read that. I think that's great.
Yeah. Mine is such a downer. It really is. I'm going to have to get better at hubbubs or something here. You guys are going to have to give me newcomer points. I just thought one story that really captured my attention this week was the report out on the status of women. Sorry, Jim, I'm going to have to do this. But mixed news for
Massachusetts. Wait a minute, it's good news for him, not good news for us. Why are you?
I don't want him, you know. It's good news for everybody. But anyway, it was mixed news for Massachusetts. The state was ranked third in the country and received a B-plus overall in terms of employment and earnings for women. Many women in managerial and professional positions in the state, but it says that women in Massachusetts will not receive equal pay with men until the year 2058. Ouch. So there's still work to do, and we're third in the country. So imagine the 40-plus others behind us. So that was, I thought, needs to just be repeated a couple of times. So
and again.
Thank you.
To your bosses.
Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Always great to have you. Thanks,
great
Jim.
Great to be with you.
And Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer. Great to have you as well.
Thank you.
And stay with us. We'll hear from a former FBI agent about how investigators piece together digital evidence in cases like the Boston Marathon bombing. I'm Deborah Becker.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.